Welcome to the Diabetes Podcast, where we rewrite the story of diabetes. If you're ready to break free from the guilt, the medication, and the fear of complications, you're in the right place. Each episode is packed with real talk, proven strategies, and inspiring wins from people just like you. Yes, remission from type 2 and pre-diabetes is real, and it starts right now. Let's get into it. Hello, I'm Richie.
And I'm Amber.
And another good day.
I think it's
a good day anyway. Today, this is to kind of recap, bring you up to speed. We are in part 4 of a 12-part series that we're calling Anything Meds Can Do, You Could Do Better. And today, we are talking about increased lipolysis, which I think I spoke a little bit to last time, is something that I don't have a lot of background in. So I'm going to turn it over to Amber and ask you to tell us all, probably more than we ever wanted to know, about increased lipolysis.
Yeah, so increased lipolysis is really these increased fat breakdown and release into the bloodstream. And these triacylglycerols, formerly known as triglycerides, are floating around. And we've talked before about skeletal muscle and how that's really responsible for about 70 to 80% of the glucose uptake after a meal in healthy people. But when you start to get fat storage inside the muscle cells, so you have these free fatty acids floating around, and these are going to go up inside the muscles. And when the fat builds up inside the muscle cells, those gates get stuck. So if you chronically consume more energy than you burn, especially in the form of simple carbohydrates and fats together, you can have some of that fat leak into your muscle cells. And those fat droplets are called intramyocellular lipids.
I have a question. We keep saying fat, but I think it's worth kind of breaking down. Like, we're not talking about fat cells entering muscle cells. We're talking about lipids. So really molecules entering muscle cells. But we're calling it all fat. But I just want to make, like, we're not talking about like actual fat cells entering muscle cells, because that's not possible. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about specific molecules in this kind of fat family that are entering my muscle cells, and I suspect messing things up. I think that's where we're going.
Mm-hmm. Kind of like the fat backbone, if you will, or the pieces that could create an entire fat cell. So you have the fact that fat storage is not really acting appropriately.
Okay.
That's part of the issue. So you've got fat spilling over into places like the liver, the muscles, the heart, and the pancreas, where it doesn't belong. And so in sedentary people, so it's not just fat storage, it's these toxic fat byproducts. And the real problem isn't just having these fat droplets inside muscle, it's what those fat droplets break down into. It's the toxic fat byproducts that they break down into. And those two things are diacylglycerols and ceramides. Well, those are two of the main things. And it's because they directly interfere with insulin signaling. So your diacylglycerols turn on enzymes that block the insulin receptor from doing its job, and the ceramides block a key part of the insulin signaling pathway, which stops, if you remember from the podcast before, GLUT4 can act independently of insulin and move up to the surface of the muscle cells and let the glucose get in without insulin. And these ceramides can stop that GLUT4 from moving to the surface to pull in glucose.
So, if, like, last week we were talking about, and I was getting really excited about GLUT4 because this was an alternate way, you know, in the absence of insulin, to get sugar out of my bloodstream into my cells. what you're saying is that these fat droplets are now even messing with that pathway.
Right. Okay. Yes, because even though insulin's knocking at the door like is gunked up. The lock won't open and the muscle cells are saying, we are full and inflamed. We do not want more glucose or sugar in here. And that creates the blood sugar going up and up and really setting the stage for more fat gain, fat buildup in the liver, and the progression of diabetes. So you can think of your muscles like sponges that are supposed to soak up sugar after you eat. So in this example, water would be the sugar and the sponge would be the sponge, the muscle soaking it up. But when fat builds up inside the sponge, it gets greasy and water repellent. So imagine you're cleaning up some bacon grease on a pan and that sponge is now water repellent. Like no matter how much water you pour on it, it won't soak up the water anymore. It just runs off.
Okay.
So basically a summary of this and like how this timeline works is first you have overeating, this chronic intake of energy, and over time the fat cells get really full and it spills into muscle cells, and fat can build up as intramyocellular or these lipids inside the fat, which creates these toxic byproducts including diacylglycerides and ceramides that interfere with the insulin signaling. And then the muscle becomes resistant to the insulin because of that interference, and blood sugar rises, and the muscle cells stop responding to insulin. Glucose can't get in, blood sugars stay high, and so the pancreas tries to put out more insulin, and the insulin levels stay high, leading to hyperinsulinemia.
Okay.
So when we talk about these high insulin levels and insulin resistance, the last podcast we talked about how that plays a role in your liver, because these free fatty acids are processed in the liver and they go there. And it's important to mention that 70% of people who have type 2 diabetes also have what's called fatty liver disease or non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, which non-alcoholic fatty liver disease is the most common cause of chronic liver disease because of this fat accumulation in the liver. As long as that, you know, we're not talking about alcoholics. So most people think of fatty liver disease being associated with alcoholics. And I know people who have this non-alcoholic fatty liver disease and diabetes, and they get really upset when they go to the hospital and people ask them about their alcohol use. And they're like, no, I don't, never drank a day in my life, or I've had a few here and there, but nothing ever looking like somebody who's alcoholic. But numerous experimental and clinical studies have shown a very strong link between this fat in the liver and oxidative stress. And in people with non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, there's this increase of oxidative stress. It's basically this metabolic syndrome and the whole cascade of events that we've talked about in the past and we'll talk about in future episodes as well. So there's also the liver involvement as well as the muscles there.
Okay. I normally say that's a lot, but
it is
today,
a lot.
This was particularly a lot.
And it's especially challenging to put into non-scientific terms because there's just so much interplay at work and so many things going on. And I say this often to people that it's not just this one thing. I think so many times people think just this one thing is happening, but it is a cascade of events that's linked to sedentary behavior and overeating and inactivity, which is sedentary behavior. But I mean, it's all of these things interconnected.
Okay. What drugs are used to treat increased lipolysis or lipodystrophy?
Those would mostly be the class of your thiazolidinediones or TZDs?
I'm gonna trick question. Can you spell that?
Thiazolidinediones. It's a mouthful.
Yeah. Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The way that these work is in the nucleus of the cell, there's a receptor. There's something called PPAR gamma. And oh my gosh, talk about, you've got your thiazolidinediones and then you have your peroxisome proliferator activated receptor gamma, which I'm just going to call PPAR gamma as much as I can. But this is one of the most powerful metabolic regulators known, especially when it comes to normal levels of glucose in the blood, lipid metabolism, and your sensitivity to insulin. This PPAR gamma is a hormone receptor that lives in the nucleus of your cells, and it's primarily expressed in your fat cells, but it's also found other places, namely the colon, macrophages, in the muscle and liver to a lower extent, and it regulates fat cell development. It's really essential for turning precursor cells into, so basically taking those stem cells and turning them into mature fat cells, and helps create these insulin-sensitive HDL production, and it enhances the expression, we've heard this before, of GLUT4, those glucose transporters in muscle and fat tissue. It encourages fat to be stored under the skin rather than around your visceral organs, which is that visceral fat that we've talked about. And in short, it really helps your body store fat in a way that is safer and more neutral from a metabolic standpoint. So if I had to like take it step by step with that, the TZDs bind to this PPAR gamma receptors, and it's like a master switch that controls the genes involved in glucose and fat metabolism. And it increases the production of proteins that makes the cells more insulin sensitive. So it's just working in so many ways, in adipose tissue, muscle, liver, and it's decreasing circulating free fatty acids, which is exactly what this is, and helping reduce lipotoxicity, which is that driver of insulin resistance and fatty liver disease. So it's really just that genetic switch. And if you've ever heard any talks on cancer and any kind of gene related anything, it's usually things that are dormant, and there's a genetic switch inside cells that turns something on or off. And TZDs flip a genetic switch inside your fat cells that help them behave better, basically storing fat more safely, sending fewer stress signals, and letting your insulin work again. So your liver stops overproducing sugar, and your muscles can take it in better like they should. So the pros of TZDs: increasing peripheral, so what's away from your visceral organs, so in the other parts of your body, increasing the disposal or getting rid of that excess glucose in your body, and improving whole body insulin sensitivity in the process. It also decreases fasting free fatty acid concentrations, and decreasing the fat that is gathering and accumulating in your liver. And interesting, some more recent trials show reduced recurrent stroke. So they've already had a stroke, they've already had a heart attack, reducing the incidence of a recurrence of stroke and myocardial infarction or heart attack in high-risk patients.
I don't remember if you said this, but what are the names of the TZDs? Like, what would they be known as?
They would be known as Actos mostly. There's also Avandia, which is less commonly prescribed due to the fact that it was off the market for a long time due to a label warning against heart failure.
Okay.
So Actos-Savandia, pioglitazone would be the Actos.
I'm going to be honest. These things sound great. Because if you're telling me that I can move fat storage away from my visceral organs and mm-hmm. to subcutaneous storage, particularly if it's protecting that again my new favorite pathway, that GLUT4 pathway, that this all sounds fantastic. What are the downsides of these medications?
There are some. I think just as an overall background history before we get into that is just. Almost all, at least in my experience with diabetes medicines, there's always the medicine that works on a particular pathway. And it would be great if the thing that they worked on was only in this one section of your body. But usually they're found other places as well. And it's the smaller amounts of whatever the drug works on that are in the other places that tend to create problems. Like if you could only have it work here, that would be great, but usually it's other places. So keep that in mind as we go through this. Your body tightly controls these PPAR gamma activation switches, and too much activity can lead to excessive fat storage, weight gain, and fluid retention. Namely, this fluid retention and heart failure. Because of sodium and fluid retention in the distal renal tubule. So basically in your kidneys, there's this retention of sodium and fluid because of the expression of this PPAR gamma in the kidney. And that leads to plasma, so blood volume, the plasma in your blood expansion, and it increases the preload of the heart. And in fact, the American Heart Association and the American Diabetes Association, for that reason, recommend caution with the TZDs and really recommend that they are not used in patients with stage 3 or 4 heart failure. So to classify heart failure, you have this New York Heart Association, different classes, and there's like different levels of perceived fatigue and different things that go along with that to classify people. But if you're in this New York Heart Association class 3 or 4, really recommend caution in people with any history of heart failure or at a high risk of fluid retention. And what's like really interesting about this to me is that the incidence and prevalence of heart failure in people with diabetes, especially those with type 2 diabetes, is significantly higher than in the general population. So like up to like almost 23% of people with type 2 diabetes have diagnosed heart failure. And we talked before about age being a major risk factor for type 2. And nearly 1 in 4 people with diabetes over age 65 have heart failure. And even more than that, have this subclinical, meaning they don't have diagnosed heart failure, but they have a dysfunction in the diastolic pressure of the heart. So there's some early heart changes that haven't caused symptoms yet being the key word. And people with diabetes are 2 to 4 times more likely to develop heart failure than people without diabetes.
So just to kind of, just to my understand, mm-hmm. like from go, this is not going to be appropriate for about a quarter of the people with diabetes.
Yeah, good summary.
So just from like, we got some good stuff here, but due to the fact that, the increased risk or existence of heart failure in the diabetic population, mm-hmm. 25% can't use this anyway. Like it's just not going to be recommended for use in those people.
Especially those with type 2.
Okay.
Yeah. And then there are other risk factors that even compound the risk on top of that. Mm-hmm. And that would be if you've had diabetes more than 10 years, mm-hmm. if your A1C is greater than 8.5, if you have hypertension, I mean, that alone is the majority of people who have type 2 diabetes, high blood pressure, hypertension. Coronary artery disease, which many physicians will tell you that coronary artery disease and type 2 diabetes are hand in hand, one in the same, kidney disease or obesity. And we know that 90% of people who have type 2 diabetes are either overweight or obese. So this doesn't include overweight, but that obesity is in there. If that's not enough, side effects, like maybe only one in four, probably less, could you know, safely use this. It can also lead to bone mineral loss. This to me is one of the biggest things, especially for women, why I don't love TZD use for people. And it can really, the reason is it can lead to bone mineral loss because remember it works on those PPAR gamma receptors and those are working in the stem cell development, like where the switch is going. And in bone marrow, you have these stem cells that can turn into either bone building cells or fat cells. And the TZDs activate that and it shifts them to more towards the fat cells than the bone building cells. And over time, that can lead to thinner bones, especially in the spine and the hips. Yeah.
Okay. This is, I do have a little bit of kind of background in this, but this is relatively new information for me. When you say bone building cells, really what we're talking about is osteoblasts.
Right.
Which
I'm proud of you.
Make new bone tissue.
Exactly.
Right?
Yes.
Which we know, let's just, you know, spell it out really explicitly. If you are the greater than half the population that's female and postmenopausal, we already know that there's going to be a problem with bone loss. And if you're telling me that the only thing that makes new bone tissue is being compromised by this particular medication, like to me, that's not just a red flag. That's a red star cluster. Holy crap. Like how do this is to me unacceptable.
If it's unacceptable to you, then we are of one accord. It is quite unacceptable, especially because this is what will do older women in. You fall and break a hip. The research regarding lifespan post hip fracture in elderly females is astronomical. I can't pull it off the top of my head right this minute, but it is really astounding. I think it's something like 2.3 years life expectancy post that, if not even less. I think it's even less, but I don't want to give an exact quote because I just can't pull it out of my brain right now, but astounding for sure.
I don't know if it's germane to this conversation. I came across a quote the other day that really kind of resonated with me, and it's essentially, you'll outlive your gonads, but you won't outlive your knees. And what that means is, at a certain point in my life, my sexual function is going to decrease. That's normal for both sexes. Mm-hmm. But the second I can't walk anymore, mm-hmm. I'm in like the express pass lane to death.
Yeah.
Is really what it comes down to. You know, yeah. And exactly like what you said, you know, I break a hip, I'm at least not walking for a while. And the second I stop walking, like I'm going to race towards all of these other complications that we've been talking. I mean, that is like the one consistent thing that I have to be able to do for as long as humanly possible, or my longevity is dynamically reduced.
Mm-hmm. And that brings me to this conversation I had just last week. And I have these conversations at least every other month with someone where this wasn't an osteoporosis TZD thing, but because this was a male person who had this diabetic neuropathy, which you don't feel things as well. And something happened that crushed his toes and he ended up having an amputation. And then because of balance and gait issues, he ended up in a wheelchair And then just like this cascade of negative things since then. He had to have a caretaker come in who stole his car. Like, it's just like I'm laughing to keep from crying. But this poor gentleman at that point just is struggling to find there were other things going on in his life financially and with disturbances of the environment in his house. And anyway, it's just a cascade of events. Like you said, things go down really quickly when you lose the ability to get around like you want to.
Wow. So if the risks of using these drugs are greater than, you know, the positives, is there a way to achieve the desired outcomes in the absence of using medication? Are there behaviors that I can adopt? And I'm pretty sure the answer is yes.
What? You know there is. Yeah, you know the answer.
What can I do if I don't want to take drugs?
Look at you feigning ignorance here. Oh my gosh. Yeah, there are natural ways to support or activate these PPAR gamma receptors and reduce fatty liver disease. And the cool thing about your liver is that unless scarring occurs, which fatty liver disease can advance to having hepatic lesions and scarring over time, but that takes time. And if you catch it early, it's very, very reversible.
What is early?
That's a great question. It is very dependent on people. But like I said before, the 10-year time frame, you know, the longer you've had diabetes, the longer it's been uncontrolled, the more insulin resistant you've been, if you've been more obese rather than overweight, like those are all risks that can come into play with that. Also, if you know, this term has been tossed around a lot, this skinny fat term. If you have a lot of fat but not a lot of skeletal muscle, there's a really good chance that you have insulin resistance, especially if you're storing fat around your midsection and your internal organs. And so that's all risk that comes into play. Ways you can increase those PPAR gamma receptors and decrease insulin resistance, all of that, increasing your intake of omega-3 fatty acids, mm-hmm. which are found in your fatty fish. You could also get that from really highly reputable fish oil supplements. You want to make sure the mercury levels are examined, independent lab verified for those supplements. Chia seeds, flax seeds, especially ground flax seeds. So we actually, I used to have a coffee grinder that was especially set aside for flax seeds because they can lose a lot of their potency once they're ground, but it's best to buy the whole flax seeds and grind them up. And the mechanism of action of that is that they activate those PPAR gamma receptors and reduce those inflammatory cytokines, those things that create the insulin resistance there. So it improves insulin sensitivity, reduces the fat in the liver, supports cardiovascular health. And then you have polyphenols.
Mm-hmm.
Polyphenols.
This is like dark green veggies.
Yay.
And bright colors in my fruits.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes. Very, very good. The really red, purple berries, green tea, coffee, resveratrol, which can be found in red wine.
That's what I'm talking about.
Dark chocolate, cocoa, turmeric, or curcumin. And then some other specific compounds that can activate these receptors would be EGCGs in green tea and quercetin. Those would be found in onions and apples, and they can be very, so an apple a day really does keep the doctor away. And last but not least would be dietary fiber and short chain fatty acids, like your beans, legumes, vegetables, whole grains, again, the flax seeds, chia seeds. And these are fermented in things that are fermented in the gut. It produces things that are really good in activating those receptors in the intestinal cells and in fat tissue. And then those short-chain fatty acids really improve metabolic flexibility, and they activate that gut tissue and the receptors that are in the gut. Then you have the monounsaturated fats, olive oil, avocados, nuts, especially your almonds and walnuts. I love the visual of the walnut cut in half, how it kind of looks like a brain. But they really improve lipid metabolism, reduce inflammation, and again, insulin sensitivity and all of that.
I got a question. Like, how do I, other than looking at the labels, which is the easiest way to do, how do I know saturated fats versus monounsaturated fats? Is there any kind of, you know, just so I can recognize how this is, you know, working in my diet?
I love that question. Your saturated fats are going to be more solid at room temperature. Mm-hmm. That's why a lot of them are used to create more shelf stable items, because we don't want to buy something and have it expire in a couple of days. We want it to last kind of forever almost in the pantry. So your saturated fats, you know, if you've ever seen a can of Crisco and opened it up, it's just white solid. That is saturated fat. If you see bacon, that white fat in there is solid at room temperature. That's saturated fat. Versus your olive oil, which would be more liquid. And even if you put olive oil in the fridge, it might turn a little bit white, but it's still pretty liquid.
Mm-hmm. So just in, I already know the answer to this. I know that nuts fall up under the monounsaturated bit, but to me, nuts seem pretty solid at room temperature. What's going on? What's going on there?
Yeah. They have cell walls and mm-hmm. they have protein. So they're in their little package. So they're solid at room temperature. But if you take all those nuts and grind them up really, like if you go to the grocery store and you grind your own peanut butter from peanuts or almond butter from almonds, and you leave it at room temperature, that fat is going to separate out, and that fat is not solid. It remains very liquid at room temperature. So,
So if I'm eating a peanut butter that at room temperature does not have that oil on top, mm-hmm. I'm guessing there's what the kids would call something sus going on with this yes. with this peanut butter.
Yes, and it's very important to specify that. And I eat natural peanut butter so often where it's just nuts and salt, and you could even get without salt or reduced salt if you needed it for different heart conditions and blood pressure, but it doesn't taste quite as good. But if you did just nuts and salt, like I'm so used to that sometimes when I am speaking with people, I forget to specify the importance of, we're not talking about, sorry, Jif or Skippy or Peter Pan peanut butter, because now they do have their natural variety some, but oftentimes in their natural peanut butter variety, they have added coconut oil, which is solid at room temperature. But it is also because it is a saturated fat. So that is not the same if you have a natural peanut butter with coconut oil added versus a natural peanut butter that's just peanuts and salt. And what we do with that in our house is we stir it up, and you have to exercise caution because the oil can spill over the side and make a big fat mess. But you want to stir it gently, and then you can go a little more vigorously once you get that oil into the solution there, and then put it in the fridge, and then it will be solid when you need it. But that's a major difference between the two. You want to have the monounsaturated. So last but not least, when we talk about ways that you can decrease insulin resistance and increase and improve this PPAR gamma expression in muscle and fat tissue, it is exercise, especially aerobic, meaning you are using oxygen in your activity, like you're able to breathe and maybe talk as you do that activity. That's one way to kind of assess if it's aerobic versus anaerobic. Yeah.
So like walking would be an aerobic activity?
Walking would be an aerobic activity, as would light jogging if your knees and your current activity level support that. But really, really looking at resistance training as well, because that's going to improve your skeletal muscle absorption of glucose. It's going to increase your overall skeletal muscle as you improve and build upon that. And if you look at all of the studies on weight loss, they, if it is isocaloric, meaning the calories are the same in the diet, but the composition of the diet is different, the weight loss is pretty much the same across those. What makes the biggest difference in weight loss is it nutrition, diet, combined with exercise, combined with over time, because that's going to improve the lean body mass that people keep with reducing calorie consumption. And, or build, it's going to build that lean body mass, which is so important for weight loss. Yeah.
And I'm going to just kind of put some additional emphasis on the resistance training bit. We talked a little bit about the osteoblasts and how they create new bone tissue.
Yeah.
If you want to turn those osteoblasts on, that is like almost exclusively resistance training, and not just resistance training. I want to lift some heavy stuff. I want to put those bones into compression in the long axis, and mm-hmm. that, you know, ladies, if you're postmenopausal, listen up. That is what creates that new bone tissue. About the only thing that creates that new bone tissue. So really, yeah, the aerobic stuff's great, but for bone health, we gotta lift some heavy stuff. That's just gonna have to be part of the regular program.
Yeah, and I just want to tie it into the last podcast that we did. Exercise also increases GLUT4 expression, gets them up to the surface of the cell, letting the sugar get into the cell without insulin. And it also improves the functioning of the mitochondria, the powerhouses of the cell. So regular exercise enhances the sensitivity and the expression of that PPAR gamma expression, even without weight loss. So you don't have to have... It is recommended, especially with fatty liver disease, especially with insulin resistance, if you could reduce 5 to 10% of your weight, that usually makes things incredibly better. But even without weight loss, regular exercise can really improve these factors.
Okay. That's great. I think that also, and again, I apologize if it sounds like we're being redundant, this same kind of message of starting to control the foods that are going in my mouth, specifically selecting the foods that are going in my mouth to reduce the effects of diabetes in my body, and then increasing the amount of activity that I'm doing. Mm-hmm. Like this is operating on basically all of the dysfunctions that we're talking about. That prescription, the non-medication prescription, seems to be pretty uniform. So that's real encouraging. Kind of makes me wonder why it's not stressed more just in going about. But anyway, we can address that in a future podcast.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you so much for joining us. I hope that you have learned something and have a takeaway from this, especially like what one thing are you going to do different today and over the next week to improve your ability to get those PPAR gamma receptors working more effectively.
All right.
Think about it.
And next week, we are going to be talking about increased hepatic glucose production,
Liver glucose production, yeah.
I think we probably could have called this series Stuff That Richie Does Not Know Anything About, because that seems to be a recurring theme every single week.
I don't think that's true. We talked about non-alcoholic fatty liver disease some today, and that's the thing with all of these core defects in diabetes. They all overlap and intertwine to some degree, and you'll start to see a lot of repetition in this. But I believe repetition is the master of skill. Mm-hmm. And we're about helping you create new habits and really understanding how all of this works to better your health, improve your insulin sensitivity, reducing your insulin resistance, and overall helping your blood sugars out. And this can help pretty much everyone, even though this is definitely more targeted to people who have type 2 diabetes or pre-diabetes. These principles is, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. These are healthy for everyone to follow.
All right. Well, again, looking Most forward everyone. To next week. And until then, take care of yourselves, and we will talk to you again soon.
I'll see you later.
Thanks for tuning in to the Diabetes Podcast, where diabetes doesn't define your future. If you liked what you heard, please share this episode and leave a review. If you want to hear more, please subscribe to hear the latest episodes. And if you're ready to take the next step towards freedom and energy, head to empowerdiabetes.com to learn how we support real change with real results. Your healthiest chapter starts now. Take courage. You can do this, and we can help.